Well, with a recent price break you're catching at the gas pump, it might last for a while. And according to the Energy Information Administration, a worsening economy continues to hammer energy commodities such as crude oil and natural gas, driving down the cost of driving cars and heating our homes. Well, that's good for the short term. But what about the long term? In a moment, David Bloom joins us. Alcohol can be a gas. David Bloom is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He's the leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. Alcohol Can Be a Gas is providing people everywhere with an unrivaled and informative look at how alcohol fuel is being used around the world to combat climate change as well as to solve energy and food shortages while creating new employment opportunities. Well, we need that. David, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Well, I'm always glad to be here, George.
My pleasure. I had an expert on the program who's been looking at this economic disaster we're in right now, and he said the one thing that this new administration can do when it takes over in January is to create an initiative of alternative fuel and to do it in a big way to turn the economy around. Would you agree with that?
Well, wholeheartedly. A whole lot of what's going on today has been certainly, if not caused, inflamed by the draining of capital out of all the world's economies to pay for oil. So alternative fuels, ones made from the sun, like alcohol or any number of our alternatives to fossil fuels, stems that hemorrhage of capital out of our country. And, boy, do we need to get a hold of some capital to get things going.
Absolutely. Now, for those who didn't hear you when you were on the show, the first time with me, give me a quick overview and a rundown on what alcohol is and how it's used and made as fuel for cars.
Well, the idea of alcohol, which is, of course, the same thing as moonshine, is that it has always been the best fuel for cars and has been around even before gasoline was ever invented. In fact, most cars used to run on it. So it's kind of an aberration that nowadays we're running on gasoline when alcohol has always been really the best fuel for internal combustion engines. And the way we make alcohol is pretty much done for us by plants. In other words, plants take solar energy. They mix it with carbon dioxide from the air and water and make carbohydrates like starches and sugars. We go ahead and ferment those just like making, say, wine or beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that part of it's done, we've got, say, 13% wine made out of corn or whatever we're using, as a good crop for making energy. We then distill it. And once we've got 190 proof to 200 proof alcohol, that's all we need to run our cars. No gasoline needed at all.
And it's cleaner, isn't it?
Well, it's about 98% cleaner than gasoline. So it's almost pollution-free, pretty darn close. But more important than that, other than pollution, is this whole greenhouse gas issue. Alcohol fuel production actually reverses global warming because plants take out a lot more CO2 out of the atmosphere to make alcohol than is released when we go ahead and burn it in the car. So if we crank up photosynthesis, crank up plant growing, whether it's marine algae or land plants, we're going to be drawing down the CO2 that's causing all the problems.
What's going on with the supply of oil around the world these days? Prices are plummeting. I mean plummeting now, and though I'd like to see them drop even more at the tank, what's happening here with this demand?
Well, there's a lot of things going on and a lot of chaff being thrown in the air that's, out there to keep us confused about the situation. Part of it is completely predictable, and I wrote about this 2 years ago, and I've pointed out that the last 10 elections or so, there's always a drop in the price of oil before the election, and then shortly after the election, it cranks back up, and by March of the following year, it's up as high or higher than it was before it dropped. That pattern's the same this year. We're going to see, a couple more weeks probably of low prices, but it won't last for very long because basically this is always done as a favor buying exercised by the oil companies with whoever's running for office. Now, in the case of the Bush administration in the last election, the midterm election, the price of oil literally started back up the next day after the election on November 7th. So it's going to take a little longer under this administration because, of course, big oil doesn't want to be right in the crosshairs of the first legislation of the new, this new administration. So what we'll see is probably something like a refinery explosion or perhaps blaming it on a cold snap and heating oil suddenly being in demand. But you'll see price start to spike within the next, well, before Christmas. Goldman Sachs.
So some event, you think, will create this push?
Well, some of that is, you know, manipulated and just waiting for an opportunity. Goldman
right,
Sachs is looking at $150 a barrel oil by January 1st. So lots of other analysts are predicting a little bit longer.
That's based on this economic mess we're in?
Well, it's independent of the economic mess we're in.
Okay.
You know, basically,
I mean, when did they make this prediction?
Well, they're basically looking at the fact that it costs a lot more money nowadays to get oil out of the ground and process it than it did 20 years ago.
Right.
20 years ago, you could process, pull a barrel of oil out of the ground and process it for, you know, maybe $10, $15. But in most of the world now, it's at least $30 or $40. So if you're selling it for $60, you're only making a 20 or 30% profit, you know, in general. And that's not enough. You know, these countries that rely on oil income to pay for everything, you know, completely artificial economies, can't live at this level for very long. So they've already started doing cuts, which is, you know, eventually going to find its way back to the United States. It's mainly causing pain in other countries right now. We're running about 2 million barrels a day short at this point, you know, less than the world actually needs.
Now, you mean short in terms of production?
That's right.
Okay.
In other words, somebody is not getting their oil. So, you know, generally this is rotated around the third world, but it can actually creep its way into the United States. So you find, you know, places like Ghana or Cameroon or Gabon, you know, these places find that they don't get all the oil they ordered, and so they have to, like, make do with whatever they get. But the oil companies are pretty good about not angering the industrialized countries unless they get a really juicy opportunity. And you and I, you know, broke that story just a few weeks ago when the oil companies took advantage of the hurricanes in the Gulf, and then they made it our turn to be short of oil. So basically we were looking at, you know, Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee having scenes right out of Mad Max where, you know, police cars were escorting gasoline tankers to gas stations to fill them up and then having to wait while the people, you know, emptied all the gasoline out of the station because the line would be 2 or 3 miles long and people would be, you know, fighting in line to, you know, get their gas to get to work, or teachers would be not able to get to school because they couldn't buy gas, or news agencies for television would go on the air saying, well, we'd like to bring you the news tonight, but we couldn't get gas for our van, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest of the country didn't even know it was happening. It was mostly, you know, kept bottled up in the southeast when gas prices were dropping and the rest of the country was going to 485 in the south. So, you know, the days of shortage or rationing, you know, aren't in the future. They just happened to us, you know, just a few weeks ago. You know, the author of The Long Emergency, Kunstler, came out with a missive the other day saying, you know, this is completely bogus. The low price of fuel right now is completely fabricated because, as you mentioned, George, the Energy Information Agency is saying, hey, our best estimates now are much worse than we thought. We're going to be going down 9% a year in production from now on. And what Kunstler says is, what are we looking at? Either a leg back up in oil prices, shortages, hoarding, or rationing. Your choice, what comes next?
And you know what's disappointing, I'm sure, for the automobile industry, David, is now that prices for gasoline are coming down to a manageable level short term, sales for cars have plummeted. And you would have thought that had the price gone down, the sales would have gone up. But this economy, nobody's going to buy anyway.
People are pretty scared right now. You know, they've had their pocketbook drained all summer by high gas prices. And then, of course, all the disaster that's happened. It was interesting for me because I was watching it from the outside when everything hit the fan on the economic front. I was in New Zealand doing a series of talks with the government and with the public there about alcohol fuel. And people were telling me there in the government, well, we may have to keep you down here, Dave. Looks like the airlines are going to collapse. You won't be able to get home.
Jeez.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting watching it from the outside melt down over the 2 weeks that I was gone and watching the rest of the world react to basically a whole lot of the capital of the world evaporating overnight and what that meant. So it really stimulated the interest of everyone in New Zealand when I was there because they had been relatively comfortable, you know, over time, you know, basically a first world country. And all of a sudden they were looking at themselves being at the very longest end of the tanker route. Like, you know, if anybody's going to get shorted, I mean, they're just like one step from Antarctica. They're pretty far away from where there's any oil. So suddenly everybody was talking about alcohol. And by the time I left, the government task forces were forming to see about converting over.
Tonight we're going to talk about the different forms of fuel, alcohol, of course, compressed air with David Bloom. And also we'll tell you how, if you want to make your own alcohol fuel, how you can do that a little bit later on in the program. Diesel fuel, still higher than gasoline. How come?
Well, you know, basically the good oil's gone. So the amount of diesel that you get out of a barrel is a lot less than it used to be. So it used to be the other way around. You got a pretty good amount of diesel and you had less gasoline left over. Diesel is something you actually have to, you know, put some effort into to get out of gasoline or out of oil. But gasoline is whatever's left over after refining, so it can vary all over the place. And, in fact, on any given day, there's maybe 400 different chemicals in gasoline. Whatever's left over from making diesel or pesticides or linoleum or lipstick or whatever, whatever's left over is thrown together in gasoline, and it's really the toxic waste of the refining industry. So we get to pay for the privilege of disposing of their toxic waste.
What about heating oil?
Oh, watch out for that. You know, heating oil is such a touchy subject.
They're talking about a severe winter this year.
Yeah, it's coming. And the thing about heating oil is that you can decide not to drive to the movie theater or not to go out to dinner, you know, and burn gasoline to get there. But you can't turn off your heater in most of the country in the winter. You have to buy that fuel. So, you know, even though gas is down a bit right now and so is heating oil, it's not it wouldn't take much of a bump at all for people to be paying more for heating oil than they are for their mortgage. And right now, you know, they're getting a little bit of a break. So tank up while you can, because basically in a couple, 3 weeks, you can expect it to really ratchet up.
And it's going to catch up to where it's been then.
Well, it'll take probably all the way to March to catch up to the $4 plus mark that we experienced this summer. But there can be some surprises in that. You know, all it takes is a couple of unexpected disasters in the oil industry, a pipeline going down, a refinery, a true refinery explosion versus one that's fabricated. And all of a sudden, you know, you're pinched for supply and they got the perfect excuse to crank up the price. Now, you know, they can modify that, but they're not likely to because they've been, you know, shorting themselves now for a couple, 3 months. And, boy, I'll tell you, when you're running $150 a barrel, you get kind of used to that when you're an OPEC giant.
That's true. Now, David, when you make alcohol fuel, give me all the various possible ingredients that you can make it from.
Well, gosh, you know, we have such a wide variety of choices. Anything with sugar or starch can be made into alcohol. So a lot of discussion goes into corn because that's what we have a lot of. But it's not a very good energy crop, maybe 300 gallons per acre, usually about 250. So we're talking right now with basically a faith-based organization that works with farmers in the South. And they're talking about a lot of these impoverished farmers switching over to growing, say, sweet sorghum, which produces over 1,000 gallons an acre. And sweet sorghum's the source for making blackstrap molasses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Looks like sugar cane, but it grows here where it's colder.
Do you get a double dip out of what you plant? You can use some of it for one thing and the rest for fuel, or does it all have to go to fuel, for example?
Well, actually, we get more like a triple or quadruple dip out of it if we do it the way we talk about it in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, because, you know, the press talks about diverting corn into alcohol plants as if the corn somehow is completely destroyed and it's used for fuel and there's nothing left. But remember, we just said what alcohol is made from, which is carbohydrate. So everything that's nutritious in the corn, the protein, the fat, the other nutrients, they're all still there when you're done making the alcohol. They're in the mash. And when you go ahead and, you know, go ahead and spin the water out of that mash and you go ahead and dry it, you can then sell what looks just like the original grain, but now it's without the starch. It's got all the essential ingredients. So since almost all of our corn goes for animal feed, we end up using the mash or the dried distiller's grains as animal feed, and we actually don't see any loss in value. In other words, or in essence, cattle actually can't even hardly digest the starch. So we're really taking what's usually going to waste, the starch that's in the corn, making it into alcohol, and making better animal feed. You know, one of my favorite stories is the way revenuers used to find who was moonshining in a given county. Is they go to the county fair and they see who had the fattest hogs and the biggest cattle. And they knew those guys had stills and they were feeding the byproducts to their animals because farmers can't help but brag, you know. So that's how they would get caught for having stills. So it's something we've known about for 100 years. And the dairy industry practically fights over the stuff that produces so much milk.
That's interesting. It truly is. You know, tonight, when we get into how you can make it yourself, do you recommend that, or should we just go to some kind of manufacturing distiller place?
Well, you know, because I'm an ecologist by training, it really bothers me when anything goes to waste. So what I'm always in favor of is making sure that we squeeze all the good stuff out of whatever it is we make into energy. And, you know, actually, this is a really good way to do business. So if you have something that's left over, the point is, make some more money from what that is and don't treat it as a waste product, which is a cost then to your operation. So if we were like throwing away this byproduct instead of using it for something else, that would actually make alcohol more expensive. Now, normally that's how things are done in America. You make something, you throw everything away. But using the byproducts as a valuable input for other products actually can make you more money. Alcohol is pretty cheap as a product. The byproducts from alcohol fuel, the way we talk about it in the book, can be enormously more valuable than the alcohol itself. For instance, if you were making, say, 10,000 gallons of alcohol a year, and that's worth maybe $25,000, the byproducts from making that much alcohol could be worth $400,000. So, you know, it's kind of like you turn it on its head. It's like the alcohol is the byproduct, and all these so-called byproducts are actually the valuable food products that we can make from alcohol, mostly for humans. And that's where we can make the money. And that's where small-scale alcohol plants have a giant advantage over the big ones.
Tell me about your speaking tour in New Zealand. What happened?
Well, boy, that was sure wild. I went down to New Zealand thinking I would talk to a couple of eco groups. And as I was there, you know, word spread because it's a small country. And I was speaking all over the place. And what was going on was really interesting because governments there, basically the equivalent of state governments, regional governments, were holding public forums just with like 2 or 3 days' notice. And, you know, 100, 200 people would show up for these things. And it was really refreshing because, you know, in some ways the New Zealanders have not had all the spirit beat out of them like a lot of places right. In the United States. So they were people ready to, you know, get on it right away. And what was really interesting is that there were people who, as kids, remember the alcohol fuel industry that was in New Zealand back when they were quite young. You see, New Zealand never got really any oil until after World War II because there weren't any tankers yet that were delivering down there.
Good
that
point.
All was a result of World War II. So people were talking about sweet sorghum and beets, and I can tell you more about New Zealand when we get a chance to come back after the break.
Thank you for that, David. We'll be back. Going to talk about all your speaking engagements here, David, but let's finish up on the New Zealand tour.
Well, New Zealand was kind of amazing because there's only, you know, 4.3 million people there, which is not a large population.
No, not at all.
But there's an awful lot of cows and sheep. Probably 10 for every person that's in New Zealand. So as I travel around New Zealand, I was continually being bombarded with, what do we do about non-point source pollution. Well, that's a big term for a lot of manure and urine washing off the countryside into rivers and lakes. Like, the rivers were so fouled with this stuff that even the cattle couldn't drink the water.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know, we sat down and talked about what one of the solutions would be, and it would make sense here and it makes sense there, which is there's a wild plant called cattails, which grows all over New Zealand in any wet spot, and we have them all over the United States. It's kind of, you know, a universal marsh plant. And what's really great about this plant is that it's 60% starch. Now, corn is only 70% starch, so corn grain. So the yield in sewage treatment plants in the United States, where we use these cattails to suck up all the nutrients out of the sewage before the waters let go into rivers or into the ocean, makes these cattails grow like all get out. So instead of 300 gallons per acre, which is what we get from corn, from cattails we get 7,500 gallons per acre. So it's an enormous amount of fuel, and we get to clean up the water and the environment at the same time. So there was a lot of, you know, heavy-duty discussion all throughout with farmers and with the government about instituting, you know, basically fuel marshes that would clean up the countryside's water and clean up the rivers, and at the same time supply the whole country with all the alcohol it would need to be able to, you know, displace all the oil that's going on in the country right now.
Now, you recently addressed the Biotechnology International Organization group in Vancouver. You talked about biofuels. Is there much interest there?
You know, that's a great story, George, because, you know, I got on that kind of because of your show. Someone called up right after I was on with you and said, we got to have you as the keynote speaker at our conference. And I said, that's great. I like to do that. And they said, well, we're the Biotechnology International Organization. I kind of look at the phone like, this is a joke, right?
Yeah,
I mean, these
exactly.
are the gene splicers. Why are they calling me? I'm not their friend, you know? So I say, you realize if you have me speak, I'll trash all of your sponsors. And the woman said, I don't care. I only work here. The boss said we need to have you. So I said, send the check first, you know? So I go to give the talk. And this is a high-powered situation. All the oil companies are there because this is all about, you know, biofuels, and using gene technology and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to give my talk, and I'm up there, and I'm going into this about – I'm into it about 10 minutes or so, and I'm being pretty hard on all the sponsors, you know, because I'm talking about the kind of solution you and I were talking about a minute ago, that real biotech
sure.
is all about – you know, making multiple uses out of all the byproducts from the process, and that's like smart biotech rather than messing with genes. And in the middle of my talk, the lights go out. Now, this is in a luxury hotel that costs $300 million. It must have 3 backup generators, and the lights go out during my talk. So someone wants me off the stage, right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't hesitate for a minute. I just start telling a story. I say, boys and girls, we're here in the dark, so I'm going to tell you a campfire story. And I tell them about when I was on, you know, years ago, I did a 10-part series for PBS on alcohol fuel, 10.5-hour shows, all the whole how-to. It was, you know, the revolution that we wanted to have in 82 to go to alternative fuels. And I got to the part where I said, you know, the reason why that show didn't go very far, it only showed once in San Francisco, is that Chevron went ahead and called PBS and said, well, what's wrong? We don't understand. We thought you liked our money. We don't want to see this on the air. So they canceled the series, and they canceled the printing of my book back in 1982.
Oh, my gosh.
So then I
used a little muscle, did they?
Well, just a little muscle. Well, one of the sponsors of this conference was Chevron. So then I say from the stage, you got to remember, everybody's in the dark, right? You know, listening to me say this, I say, well, the sponsor from Chevron, please get his hand off the light switch. And the lights went back on. But, you know, I'll tell you what was the spooky thing about this, because these guys are talking about some really awful things. Like, for instance, Chevron and Weyerhaeuser were up there saying, well, here's our plan. We're going to take the forests of the Southeast, and we're going to make synthetic fuel from it. And everybody's waiting to say, oh, yes, cellulosic ethanol, you know, because that's what's all in the press. And they said, oh, no, we're not going to make cellulosic ethanol, because we'd get the same tax credit as the alcohol guys, if we make synthetic gasoline out of trees. We don't think that there should be an alternative on the market because that's inconvenient. We should just stick with gasoline, and we'll make artificial gasoline out of the woods of the Southeast, and Weyerhaeuser and Chevron are working together on this. So that was creepy. And then DuPont gets up there and says, well, we've got a process where we're going to make, you know, alcohol first, but then we're going to convert it into synthetic fuel for gasoline and diesel engines. And Honeywell gets up there and says the same thing. So these guys are all talking about turning cellulose or plant matter into synthetic gasoline instead of alcohol, just because if you do it that way, then you don't let the farmers in on the deal. In other words, they can't make synthetic gasoline. These are all patented processes, but they sure can make alcohol. So I got up and addressed the panel from the audience, and I said to them, you know, it sounds to me like your plan is to try to convince farmers to grow, you know, plant fiber for you, you know, grass for $250 per acre per year. And that's like every farmer knows that the last thing you do before you go broke is grow grass. You know, what we're talking about with alcohol fuel is farmers making $5,000 or $10,000 an acre growing sorghum or beets or Jerusalem artichokes.
And that's huge money for them.
And that's like good money. So I said, you guys up there, you know, you guys, you know, on the stage, you have a problem with your business plan. And it sounds to me like you're declaring war on the farmers. So I got to tell you, we're going to declare war on you. And I walk away from the microphone. So, you know, basically people came to me from all kinds of other countries who were at this conference saying, well, the big guys just told us they don't need us, they don't want us, and we have all these labs, and we can, you know, we want to do what you're doing. It's a lot more fun talking about what you're doing, which is taking corn and making alcohol and then taking the byproduct and feeding it to fish. And then taking the byproduct from the fish, all the fish water manure, and using that to go ahead and grow vegetables. You know, in other words, that kind of biotech where we make use of everything in the process. They all said, oh, that's what we'd much rather do than splicing genes. Let's, you know, have you come to Russia. Let's go do this there, you know, and, you know, forget these guys in the U.S. And the guys in New Zealand, you know, gosh, they were saying, oh, you don't have an institute or land in the U.S. yet? Well, we'll give you 100 acres of citizenship, no problem. So it's like, you guys are going to lose me here in the United States if we don't find land and some money for me to stick around here.
Do we have processing plants for alcohol?
Oh, yeah. We got about 124 of them, I think, all over mostly the Midwest, but there's also some in other places.
Big ones for enough capacity, or would we really, if we really kick this up, we'd need to build some, right?
We need to, but you know, George, what I talk about in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, is big is not better. What we need is a lot of small plants all over the country that are operated by, well, people like you or I. You know, it's, gosh, it's not rocket science to make moonshine. We've been making it, well, it's mankind's second oldest profession. We know how to do this, you know. So what we really ought to be doing is talking about small plants in every county in the United States instead of great big giant plants, because the big plants, they're vulnerable. Right now, a lot of big plants are close to going bankrupt because the oil companies have been manipulating the price of corn over the last year and a half.
Now, how have they done that?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. You know, and in my book, I talk about why you got to stop them from gaming corn before they actually did it, and that you should, you know, put controls on the futures market, because what they do is go out and buy corn futures at a high price. That means the alcohol guys have to pay a lot for the corn. Well, of course, that cuts into whatever profit they're going to make. And at the same time, the oil companies control the futures market for the alcohol because they buy it to blend with gasoline. So they put the farmers and the, you know, who own these plants and the companies that own these plants in a nutcracker over the last year and a half. And then they blamed alcohol for the price of corn going up. Well, it turns out that there's a whole investigation going into that right now, and they're discovering that, as someone put it, the oil companies had their thumb on the scale. So they buy these corn contracts at a high price, and then they'd sell them off to their buddies at General Mills or Kellogg or whatever at a low price and take the loss so that alcohol plants would be put in a bad position. They could afford to do that because they made, what, $124 billion last year, losing a couple of billion. To put the competition out of business is like, well, that's not even a conspiracy. That's just business as usual. So, you know, readers of the book have been writing to their Congress people saying, investigate the commodities futures trading. And, you know, and they have. And in the, as soon as the investigation got going, the price of corn cratered. And it's down to where it was before all the propaganda about food versus fuel. It's down about $3.60 a bushel now, when during the height of the propaganda this summer, it was like at $8. So farmers at this point are saying, whoa, what are we going to do? Because last year, there was no shortage of corn. There was no reason for the price to go up. We had a surplus of 1.6 billion bushels. And they're still sitting in the silos. And it's like, where are we going to put all the corn for this year? And now the price has been cut. So one of the things I'm really afraid about, and I really want people to, if they can, go to our website and check this out.
Which is which one?
Oh, God, here we go, George. Last time we did this, you totally toasted my website.
We're going to do it again.
Here we go. All right, so let's see if we can hold up to you this time.
You also have little ideas on how people can do this themselves, right?
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So the website, of course, is alcoholcanbeagas.com. And you can find out all about, of course,
B spelled B-E, right?
Yes, just like you'd expect, alcoholcanbeagas.com. And we have a number of things going on the website, but part of what we have going on is we're really trying to build up a huge list of people that can help write when the oil companies do these kind of shenanigans so that we can put pressure on our Congress people in a grassroots way. So we have incentives right now, if you'll just join our mailing list, so we can send you these notices once in a while when we have to, as a grassroots, you know, group of people, stop the oil companies from what they're doing. So we'd really encourage you to do that.
You don't think, just using corn for an example, if we really divert corn to ethanol on a massive basis, that we're going to cause any starvation around the world, which is, again, what they say?
Well, you know, the first thing they say about that, of course, assumes that there's not enough corn. In other words, if alcohol producers and food producers are competing for corn, then the price goes up and there's a shortage of corn around the world. But as I just said, there was a surplus last year. In the middle of all this propaganda, the reality was not only was there not a shortage, there was a flood of extra corn. So, like, you know, when you talk to a reporter, you say, what part of surplus don't you understand? It's like, how can the price go up when there's a surplus? Because we all know about capitalism. If you have a surplus of something, the price goes down normally. And if there's a shortage, the price goes up. No shortage, the price shouldn't go up. So the other thing that you got to remember is that 90% of our corn is fed to cattle. And as we just talked about a minute ago, taking the starch out has no effect on how much meat we get because cattle can't digest starch. When you feed 10 pounds of corn to a cow, 1 pound becomes meat. Well, that means the other 9 pounds went somewhere, didn't it?
Yep.
It went out the back door. And most of that is starch. So we've been wasting the starch all this time. So here's the funny thing about it, actually. If you feed the byproduct to the cattle instead of the original corn, you actually get 17% more meat. So not only is the problem—
And it's safe for the cattle.
Oh, yeah. Farmers have been feeding mash to cattle since they've been moonshining, which is like a few thousand years.
You might have some drunk cattle, but—
And they like that. So— So, in other words, the food versus fuel thing has been completely fabricated, and basically the press has been sucked in, and progressives have been sucked in, and basically repeating the same things over and over. And here we go. The price of corn cuts in half. The same amount of alcohol is being produced, so clearly alcohol has no effect on the price of corn or its availability. And yet, you know, if you tell that lie enough times, people start to believe it. So it's one of the things we really explore in the book. And if you go on our website, you can see excerpts from the book where we talk about the food versus fuel issue and, you know, get yourself educated on that. So when somebody says that to you next time, you can point out that that's American Petroleum Institute propaganda, and it has no basis in fact.
This email, and give me your take on this. He said, one of our listeners, the largest crop in the U.S. by weight is grass clippings, which are cellulose. If every county had an alcohol plant turning green waste into cellulose, into alcohol, we would replace a lot of our fuel.
Yeah, you know, I have a chart in the book where I talk about that specifically. It's actually the largest irrigated crop in the United States is lawn. But what's interesting about lawn is we use more fertilizer and other chemicals on our lawns than we do on the whole corn crop. So, you know, the whole issue about the energy that goes into growing crops, it's like you start looking at lawns and it's like, who cares about energy, right? Who's really caring about energy when, you know, chemical-based fertilizers are being used on our lawns? We can replace about 11 to 15% of our total fuel just from our lawns, processing that instead of sending it to the landfill.
That's pretty dramatic.
Well, it's not just dramatic. It's like what's amazing is how little land that is. You know, it's just a little bit of patches of green around our houses and golf courses, and yet it adds up to 30 million acres, where corn, get this, is only 70 million acres.
Oh, my God.
So our lawns are actually a huge amount of acreage, but when you look at the total acreage of the United States that's good for agriculture, we actually only use 5% of our agricultural land for corn. But if you listen to the pundits, you would think that we're using every bit of it for corn and there's no room left for anything else. We have so much land in this country, George, just like New Zealand, where we can go ahead and become an alcohol exporter after replacing all of our transportation fuel with alcohol, and probably start to replace a lot of our coal and nuclear for electricity as well.
You know, venture capital money's not going there. Of course, there's not that much available right now anyway. What are you going to do for money that you need to develop these plants?
Well, you know, it's cheap to develop these plants, though, George. I mean, cheap, and I mean, you take a look at what we've spent lately on everything that's been going on, and alcohol plants are a bargain. In other words, we can build alcohol plants for somewhere in the neighborhood, and this is, you know, small plants, big plants, $1 to $2 a gallon. You know, and a buck is normal. So you want a 10 million gallon per year plant? Cost you $10 million. But that permanently, that $10, you know, that
and when you say $10 million plant for $10 million, are you saying that's what it would produce a year, 10 million gallons?
That's right.
Okay.
So let's look at the whole world supply of fuel. It's a big number. It's 500 billion gallons a year. We think, oh, my God, that's a lot of fuel. So luckily, the math is easy to do. $1 times 500 billion is $500 billion. We could replace every bit of gasoline and diesel in the world permanently. That's the world, not the U.S., for $500 billion. And we would, and you start thinking about what we've spent that kind of money on. Like, I seem to remember that $780 billion figure that we just shoveled into the hands of the wealthy who made bad investments.
And we don't even know where it went or where it's going.
We'll never know where it goes. And so we could have taken that money and we could have permanently replaced the world's supply of fuel, plus had a couple of hundred billion left over to build stations all over the world to sell the stuff that wouldn't even be owned by the oil companies.
See, that's the other thing. David, we'll be back. We're already done with this hour. We'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. If you ever need to email me, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. David's website, alcoholcanbeagas.com. And our guest tonight, David Bloom, as we talk about alternative energy and fuel, Alcohol Can Be a Gas is his latest work, his book, and we'll be back with David in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Tell us a little bit more about what the oil companies are doing to curtail alcohol fuel competition today. You talked about the corn. Are they doing anything else?
Well, you know, the oil companies have multiple strategies about alcohol, and the whole thing is they really absolutely need to delay our getting into alcohol fuel. So anything they can do to stall it is just fine, because basically where they want to go and where they're already going, because oil is running out, or at least the easy oil to get is not as easy to get as it used to be, is they're looking at, you know, synthetic alternatives to petroleum. And so we already get more of our oil from Canada than we do from Saudi Arabia. And that's not oil. That's tar sands. So that stuff is really foul. It's basically gooey, tarry stuff that isn't even quite oil yet. It has to be processed into an oil. But it takes like 5 barrels of natural gas to get 1 barrel of tar sand, because you got to melt it out of it. So from a global warming point of view, this is like, you know, a route to hell. Now, if you start talking about some of the other things they want to do, and they're already developing them, like oil shale to fuel or coal to gasoline, these things are environmental, you know, complete nightmares. And the only way that they're going to get us to buy those, because they all cost about $150 a barrel to produce, is if they panic us into it. And we've all just seen what happens when the banks panic us into, you know, doing things in a matter of a couple of weeks. We spend $780 million and say, thank you for saving us. We're not sure from what, but you sure got us panicked and we did it.
Exactly.
So when it comes to, you know, what you and I talked about just a few weeks ago in Georgia is what they'll do to us on a national basis, which is they'll get us into a place where all of a sudden there won't be enough gas at the gas stations and the price will be suddenly $5 a gallon, and we'll beg them to do whatever it takes to fill those stations again. And what stops that plan from happening is if Americans get out there and start making alcohol, because we can make it for, you know, $40, $50, $60 a barrel. And what I'm talking about, folks, is basically you making it yourself for a dollar a gallon or going into the small business of it. If you do that, it never makes sense to go to oil shale or tar sands or turn godforsaken coal into, you know, gasoline. And the thing that's really important about that is who gets the money. Because when you spend that money on these foul sources of energy, it goes to, you know, Geneva bank accounts. But if, you know, you make alcohol in your town and you're selling it in your town, well, it's a whole different effect. In other words, let's say Farmer Bob makes the alcohol and sells it in town. So you buy some of that alcohol with your dollars. And if we're still using dollars by then, who knows? But anyway, you know, it goes to the farmer, and now he needs to get his truck fixed. So he takes some of your dollars and goes with his, you know, alcohol money to a mechanic, gets his truck fixed. The mechanic takes that alcohol money and goes down the street and gets a haircut. The, you know, barber goes down the street and takes the alcohol money and gets a massage. The massage therapist wants some organic food, goes back to Farmer Bob, who's got greenhouses on at the alcohol plant, using the fish water to raise the vegetables and using the carbon dioxide from the fermenters to get three times the yield of organic vegetables. But the point is, that little business just sent the money around the community and back again. It didn't leave the community. So we're talking about capital here, and we've all just seen what happens when capital disappears. It disappears every day to Geneva for the oil companies when we buy gasoline. But if we buy our alcohol locally, now we're injecting essentially a huge amount of capital that was being drained away to all the businesses in our community. So it's not just the jobs at the alcohol plant that are important. It's how that money circulates through the economy, and the basic rule of thumb is about a 22 times multiplier effect. So if we went to alcohol, and if I was, you know, if I could get to our new president-elect, I would say, look at this. If we go ahead and convert even part of the country to alcohol fuel, we could create 20, 30 million new jobs.
Oh, that's brilliant. It really is.
And they're American jobs. They can't be exported.
Let's go through some various stages here, from the vehicles, the creation, the distilling. First of all, somebody wants to do this at home. Do they need a permit? Do they have to go to the Department of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms? What do they do there on that stage?
Well, you know, George, if you would ask me that question when we first went on in July, I would have said, oh, yeah, you know, there's a simple permit to get. It's, you know, free. It's only two pages. And, you know, an alcohol can be a gas. We show you how to fill that out so that you get it right. But that's all changed.
Already?
Oh, let me tell you what you and I did, George. When we went on the air and basically 2 million people got interested in this whole thing and, you know, lots of them bought the book and they filled out their permits, they sent it into the government and thousands of permits started arriving. And there were only like three guys there to process them. So they started sending them back to people and saying, we're not processing your permit because, you know, basically, you know, we can't possibly handle all these. So when you finish building your still, let us know. Now, think about this for a minute. This is like going to build your house and going to the building department. They're saying, sorry, just go build your house and let us know when you're finished. You know,
and all is well?
Oh, absolutely.
They're not going to say, sorry, no permit. You can't use it.
No.
After you go ahead and spend the money to build it.
George, all your Coast listeners who did this, have the people in the office at the ATF all excited. All the people in the office are starting to build their own cells at home.
Are you kidding me?
No, call them yourself. There's only three people there. You'll get to talk to them. They'll tell you the same story. So, you know, so in other words, we've already broken the government using the listeners from coast to coast. So we just broke that whole part of the government. It doesn't operate. And basically, you're supposed to let them know at some point that you've built your still, but they won't even process your permit at this point because we've overwhelmed them.
Interesting. Okay, so we build this still. Where do we get the parts for the still? I know you've got some information on your website, alcohol can be a gas, but what do you recommend people? If somebody wants to just make, you know, a few gallons a week, what's he do?
Well, if you're only going to make that much, we have plans on the website that you can buy, and, you know, done by a former student of mine, you know, from one of my workshops. And
do you have kits too?
Well, actually, you know, making alcohol kits is on its way. We have kits for converting cars, but we can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But the making alcohol, the book actually shows you how to make alcohol at scales anywhere from 2 gallons an hour up to, you know, around 30 to 40 gallons an hour. In other words, a pretty good business.
40 is a pretty good business. You could sell that to the neighborhood.
Oh, you could sell that to a couple of hundred people. Yeah. In other words, that's like more than 250,000 gallons a year.
Any danger producing this stuff? Is it going to blow up on me or anything like that?
Well, you know, in California, it's hard to illustrate this because, you know, there's no smoking in bars here. But, you know, if you've ever been in a bar and you've seen somebody with a martini and a 1,200-degree cigarette right nearby,
yeah,
martinis explode all the time, right?
Yeah. No, I've never seen that happen. Never seen that happen.
So alcohol is a lot safer than gasoline.
Okay. So, all right. So let's say we produce 10 gallons, okay, for the lane. We've got a little machine in our garage or wherever we are.
Sure.
And we produce 10 gallons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you do with it? You just dump it in your gas tank?
Well, literally, that's all you have to do. You can run your car.
And what's the ratio?
Well, here's the deal. If it's a little different depending on what you're doing. So if you want to, like, make no modifications to your car whatsoever, because remember, it originally was an alcohol car back one day in the past.
A long time ago.
But so if you want to go ahead and run it on alcohol with no modifications, you put in up to 50% alcohol, and you don't have to do a darn thing.
So if you've got a 15-gallon tank, you can put 7 gallons in it.
That's right. And, you know, there are 2,000 stations in the United States that actually sell alcohol at the pump.
Does it hurt if you only want to put in 1 or 2 gallons?
No. Every bit you put in is another...
Enhances.
Well, it's also another few dollars you didn't give to the oil company.
That's right. And does it increase mileage or not?
Up to, you know, it's very interesting. It's not a straight relationship. If you go up to about 30 or 40% alcohol, it usually has little to no effect or a slight increase in mileage. If you go all the way to straight alcohol, which typically requires you to make a conversion, well, you know, you're using an engine that's optimized for gasoline, so you'll typically lose maybe 10, maybe 12% miles per gallon. But if you're making it for a buck a gallon, who cares?
Right.
Right. So, so you could actually, now this is, you know, you're asking about kits. We just this week started selling kits on our website that you can literally snap onto the fuel injectors of your car. It's a little additional computer. And what it does is it adjusts for the difference between alcohol and gasoline. Alcohol needs less air than gasoline, you know, in proportion, because alcohol has oxygen already in it.
Right, that's true. It's a big difference.
And, you know, to accommodate that difference, basically you need a little bit smarter computer. And they make those already in Detroit. I mean, you can buy cars that are already flex fuel. They'll run on alcohol, they'll run on gas, they'll run on any mixture. But if it doesn't come that way, well, these additional kits you can snap on make it just like a flexible fuel car. So now you can put whatever you want in the tank. So
at any ratio?
That's right. So in other words, you can be running around for the next few weeks on straight alcohol, you know, that you make yourself or you buy at the local
Or all gasoline if you want to.
If you have to go on a long trip, you just start putting gasoline in, and the kit automatically adjusts. You don't have to think about it because it's got a pretty smart little brain in it.
Interesting.
So if you go on our website, we have right on the front page a link that lets you find your local alcohol station, because there are 2,000 of them in the United States, and you can go ahead and get started right away adding some to your tank. Now, we talked a little bit about this back in July, so let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
I mean, coast to coast.
And we seem like we've done a lot here.
You have done a lot for the revolution, let me tell you. So here's what happened after we talked about this in July. The following month, the increase in the amount of straight alcohol sales went up 70% in 1 month after our show.
You've got to be kidding.
Oh, I'm not. I'm not. And in fact, it was such a dramatic increase that the Petroleum Marketing Association sent out a letter to all the stations that sold alcohol saying, and you can't let people who don't have flexible fuel cars put alcohol in their tank because you might be liable for something. And well, it might be illegal in some way. And you need to tell your minimum wage gas station jockeys to stop people from putting that alcohol in their tank. It was the most amazing letter. It was like 2 weeks after our show. So many people went out there and started putting alcohol in their tank, it panicked the oil companies into writing this letter.
Now, how much were they selling the alcohol for?
Well, here's the deal. You know, in July, when we you know, let people know that
gasoline was sky high.
Yeah, gasoline was like $4.20, $4.30 in Chicago, and alcohol was $2.75.
Okay.
So people are saying, well, this is a no-brainer. I'm just going to start putting it in the tank. But think about it this way for a minute. You know, you've got millions of listeners. So let's say a million of them go do this. And that's, you know, 500 gallons a year for each one of those people, or 500 million gallons of gasoline they don't buy. And whether it's alcohol they buy instead. And if we look at next year's prices being $5 a gallon, that means Coast listeners just took $2.5 billion out of the oil company's pocket. So if we did a million last time, let's do another million this time. I want a million of you guys out there listening to start trying it out and putting alcohol in your tank.
Now it's comparable to gasoline prices now, though, right?
Well, actually, alcohol is 20, 30 cents a gallon cheaper than gasoline.
Okay.
But when gasoline goes back up, alcohol is hardly going to go up at all.
Right.
So, and of course, you can start making it yourself, but you don't have to wait to make it for yourself. I mean, great if you get the book, build your still. I encourage you to do that. But in the meantime, don't wait. Look up on our website where your local alcohol station is. Start putting alcohol in your car because, you know.
Can you do this for motorcycles, too?
Absolutely.
Things? Okay.
Absolutely. Motorcycles are great because, you know, they run hot. They have all those fins on the, you know, on the outside of the
engine. Oh, yeah.
Well, I used to run a motorcycle on alcohol back in the 80s, back when I was young and stupid and liked motorcycles. And I broke all
the... Yeah, now you don't have to be stupid. You have to be safe.
Well,
you got a lot of enthusiasts.
Let's say I was stupid and I wasn't safe when I rode
a
motorcycle.
That's better.
So I took a hammer and I broke all the fins off the head of the motorcycle because it was running too cold. Because alcohol burns so much cooler than gasoline that I didn't even need the cooling fins to keep my engine cool, you know, on my motorcycle. So people would look at my bike and they just couldn't figure it out because they figured it would just burn up. You could actually put your hand on the exhaust pipe of the motorcycle because alcohol burns so cool that you could actually wrap your hand around the exhaust pipe and not take off three layers of skin. So that's really important because what that means is more of the fuel is turning into work and less of it is turning into waste heat. So that also has another important aspect, which means if more of it's turning into work, less of it is turning into smog or unburned fuel. So it's great that alcohol is 98% pollution free, but it also means no carbon in your engine. So the inside of the engine stays bright and shiny clean because there's no hydrocarbon leftovers. It all burns very, very, very completely. What that means, of course, is that carbon is what wears your engine out. It's like microscopic sandpaper. It gets down in your oil, washes up and down on the sides of the cylinder when the pistons are going up and down. And that's what wears out your engine. So you typically get triple the engine life on alcohol than you do on gasoline. And, you know, when you start looking at how much money you have in your pocket now compared to what you had before we gave it all to the banks, you know, making that engine last twice or three times as long is really important. Or let's say you're driving a truck tonight, and I know a lot of you truck drivers are out there because you've been calling me the last couple of months. You know, we've seen diesel engines that have been run on alcohol, because you can run diesels on alcohol with some modification, that have run 1 million and 2 million miles without having to be rebuilt. And then you rebuild them, and you run them another million or 2 million because you just don't see hardly anywhere. We've seen gasoline vehicles after a half a million miles running on alcohol. You tear them apart. 60% of the original machine marks inside the cylinder are still there. So the engine is hardly, is just barely broken in. You could throw that back together and run it another half million miles.
At the end of the program tonight, which will be next hour, we're going to give David some time so he can explain to you how you can participate in all of this. Do you find this growing, this support base?
Oh, my gosh. You know, Tom is, you know, sitting in my office. He's been sending me emails while we've been talking. He's saying, you know, so many people are going on the mailing list right now because they want to help just from our talking about it. I got to tell you, over the last few months, you know, so many people have been jumping into this. We have hundreds of people building stills around the country. Thousands of people are converting cars. We've got used car lots buying kits to go ahead and convert the vehicles on the lot because they can't move them, you know, these big vehicles.
Yeah.
And there's, the way they're moving them is by putting on our dual fuel kit so they can convince people to buy the vehicles because now they can buy cheaper fuel. I mean, governments are putting it on police cars. You know, this revolution has left the station, you know, and it is really taking off.
That's fantastic. Truly is. We're going to take Fast Blast questions next half hour for David Bloom
cool.
when we come back. That is always fascinating indeed. Are you training people to build these areas around the country?
Yes, we have workshops coming up, mostly at the demands of Coast listeners. And so we've started scheduling them. We've got some talks coming up around Chicago next week that are short talks in Normal, Illinois, and at ISU near Chicago. But we have full-on workshops starting this spring, the first one in Chicago in February, but we're right now scheduling them around the country. And so if you write to us, tell us where you want a workshop so we know where to put them.
And the percent of items grown, what would be the highest item that you think could be used for this then?
Well, you know, each area is different. Depends on what your soil is, what your weather is. But the cattail thing is really catching people's imagination.
Cattails, really?
Yeah, we mentioned that a little bit.
Yeah, you did last time.
And we talked a little bit about New Zealand. And because we can get so much yield per acre, you know, we've got a model that we've drawn up which we want, and people are starting to build it, so we don't have data yet. But basically, if you replace your septic field with a 20-foot wide by 200-foot long cattail marsh, so that's one-tenth of an acre. A lot of people have a tenth of an acre. That's not a problem. You can actually produce more than 1,000 gallons of alcohol, which is all you need to run your family's cars and even some of your heating for the year. And, you know, it's really an exciting idea that we can start taking, you know, very small pieces of land like this, and people can grow cattails, cut them down with a machete, and process them in their own still.
That is something. Stay with us. Fast Blast questions next for David Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. David, how soon would it take you to get your money back on savings to pay for your equipment, you know, the little distiller?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because there's a couple of ways to look at that. I mean, you can look at the money you're going to save on gasoline, of course, and that really depends on the price of the gasoline. But there's other ways that you get your money back. In other words, let's say when you build a still and you start making alcohol, you get tax credit for every gallon that you produce. So if you're looking at just the federal tax credit, it's about 61 cents a gallon. So here you are producing your alcohol for $1 a gallon from, say, donuts. And you're getting back 61 cents from the federal government for every gallon you produce.
Now, how do you verify that?
Well, you know, you're supposed to keep really good records, George.
Okay. Okay.
Really good records.
Yeah.
You know, excellent records, in fact. So, you know, and you got to do that anyway for the revenueers. So
sure.
You might as well do it for the IRS. So you turn in your paperwork at the end of each month, and 90 days later, they send you a check. Now, I got to tell you, you know, there aren't many better days on this planet when you get to screw the oil companies and the IRS all in the same day. Now, in some states, there are actually equipment credits. So like in Oregon, for instance, they give you a 50% tax credit on the cost of building your still. So let's say you build a still for $1,500, and this is a still that might make you 100 gallons a day.
Okay, so $1,500 would give you about 100 gallons a day.
This is assuming, you know. You could,
and that's a lot.
100 gallons a day? Yeah. Oh, yeah, no kidding. That's a lot.
If you're doing it just for yourself, that's way more than you need.
If you ran it every 3 days, you know, every third day, you'd make 10,000 gallons a year.
Jeez, okay.
You know, so that's you and a bunch of neighbors. Now, of course, that assumes you can weld and you're cheap like me and you go out and scrounge yourself a used tank or something
I'd like to get a brand new shiny kit.
Oh, gosh. Well, George, you know, now you're walking into a plug for me because we're in the middle of trying to capitalize the company to build them so that you can actually just buy them. But that'll come along over the next year. But right now the book teaches you how to make your own or hang out with a neighbor who knows how to weld and do it together. This cooperation thing really works, you know. So how fast do you get your money back? Well, heck, if you're making 10,000 gallons a year and you're all saving a couple of bucks a gallon, I think you get your money back in like the second month. So.
And how much space does this thing take up?
Well, something that'll make 10,000 gallons a year like that takes up less space than your car.
And do you plug it in, or what's the source of energy for it?
Well, you know, I like to use something that's renewable. So I typically will use some sort of waste wood, old pallets, or even firewood if I live in a rural area, you know. If you're looking at firewood, the cost for making your alcohol, if the wood is $250 a cord, the energy it takes to make your alcohol is about 11 cents.
Well, now that I'm not sure I would want to do in my garage.
You want probably do it in your backyard.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, most people put their stills outside. It's easy to, you know, there's nothing about them that needs to be indoors, you know.
So if it snows or rain on it, no big deal.
Nope, just made out of steel, you know.
Okay.
So, mm-hmm.
All right, let's go to some questions. Ready?
Yep.
Michael in Ramona, California, wants to know about butanol.
Well, butanol is a different alcohol. You know, ethanol is a 2-carbon alcohol. Isopropyl alcohol is a 3-carbon alcohol, and butanol is 4-carbon. So it's also made by fermentation, but instead of using yeast, you know, the same yeast that make wine or beer, it uses a special bacteria which takes the sugars or starches and makes them into butanol. Now, the trouble with it is yeast have been around for millions of years making alcohol, and you can get a batch that's 13-14% alcohol, and then the yeast get dead drunk and keel over. Now, you know, because you've looked, just think about the last bottle of wine you looked at. You know, it says right on the label it's 13% alcohol. So yeast can tolerate a lot of alcohol. Bacteria can't. You get up to 1-1.5% alcohol or butanol, and it kills the bacteria. So you need a tank 10 times as large to make the butanol. The other problem with butanol is that it's, well, poisonous. You know, I mean, alcohol, well, some of us may have woke up after a night of drinking and feel like we've been poisoned, but generally doesn't kill us. You know, butanol is pretty toxic, so you have to handle it carefully, and its emissions are about as dirty as gasoline. So although it's renewable, it's not, you know, necessarily what we prefer to make. And it's, you know, it's not easy to ferment with bacteria. It's like yeast. Yeast are just tough little critters. They really do the job without a lot of trouble.
Okay, next up, let's go to Phil in Memphis, Tennessee. And I know you mentioned you'd like to get your plans to Barack Obama, but why don't you just send it to, this is his question, Obama's transition team?
Oh, well, that's what I mean. I mean, anybody in that team, you know, who, I'm concerned because there's going to be a lot of shenanigans that are going to go on with the oil companies between now and the time of inauguration. So, like, one of the things that's going on now with the drop in the price of corn is they're going to break a lot of farmers in the next 2 or 3 months. And who's going to be standing there to buy up the land? It's going to be the corporation fronts for the oil companies because they want that solar collecting surface. Now that there's a commitment to biofuels, they want to monopolize that too if they can. And boy, let me tell you, you don't want the oil companies in charge of your food supply. So, you know, stuff has to happen soon, and there's a lot of other policy things we can do. And gosh, anybody on that team that I can get to talk to, you know, send me to them, get us in connection, whatever, you know.
Lamar from Kingsland, Georgia, wants to know if you know much about the compressed air cars that are coming out of France.
Well, yes. Now, you know, last time I checked, there wasn't like this compressed air mine you could go ahead and, you know, just collect compressed air from. You need energy to compress the air. So whatever you're using to compress the air is really the energy that's running the car. Compressed air is a way of storing energy. You know, it's not a source of energy. So if you run a compressor with electricity, then you're really running your car on electricity, even though you're using, you know, stored electricity as compressed air. It's kind of like a hybrid car. You know, you can put electricity into a hybrid car, and you're running on the batteries. And when you go to slow down, well, the car generates a little electricity, and you store it in the batteries. Same is true with a compressed air car. If it slows down, you know, that can run a compressor to compress some air, and that slows the car down. So it's a variation on a hybrid car, but it doesn't get you out from using some kind of energy to run it. So whatever you're running your compressor with better be renewable, and that could be alcohol. You could run the compressor with a gasoline motor, you know, converted to alcohol, and run your air compressor with that, and then you'd have a car that at least is using renewable fuel.
Harv from North Carolina. And you touched on this with motorcycles, I assume. Would it work on little scooters, too?
Oh, yeah. I used to have a little, I guess they used to call them PUC mopeds, P-U-C-H. And I have pictures of that in my book and on the website. And basically, we converted that to run on alcohol. And I occasionally would pour in a Bacardi 151 when a reporter would want to take a ride on it. It was, you know, a lot of fun that way.
Dan from St. Petersburg, Florida. And again, you can answer this. Again, please tell me, what about modifications made to our cars to run on alcohol?
Well, you know, there's a number of modifications that you can make, and you don't even need to buy our kit. You know, in other words, the kit's convenient. It's really easy. But the book shows you several ways to inexpensively modify your car using off-the-shelf parts. So the key thing is changing the air-fuel mixture. There's different ways of fooling your car into thinking it's running on gasoline when it's really running on alcohol. And also, we can tune the car differently. Alcohol is 105 octane, so that means we can advance the timing. In other words, time it, you know, set the spark to go off at the timing that's more like a race car, and that improves your mileage and reduces your emissions even further. And there's other tricks we can do, too, which we get into detail in the book, like with alcohol, because it's not, you know, toxic waste from a refinery. It's a specific substance. We can actually heat the fuel up pretty warm before we squirt it into the engine. It breaks into smaller particles when it sprays into the engine, and that gives us better mileage. So there's tricks we can do with alcohol that we can't do with gasoline.
Randy from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Can I go out of the back woods behind my house, pick up all the dead stuff in the woods, and use that as clippings and make alcohol out of it?
Well, you know, everything about a plant starts off by being sugar. So, you know, plants make sugar first, and then they can link a bunch of sugars together to make starch, like 35 of them make starch. But when plants want to make plant fiber, they link together tens of thousands of sugars together in long threads, and then the threads are stuck together side to side. This is pretty, you know, plants make cellulose, this plant fiber, to be really resistant to breaking down. I mean, gosh, trees last 70, 80 years, right? You know, even 100 years, and they don't break down. So trying to make alcohol from all that woody stuff is not something that's really possible right now on the small scale. You know, you can certainly do it on the big scale. Paper mills do it every day. They break down cellulose, and actually they produce a lot of sugar. But they stop breaking down the cellulose because they want to keep the fiber to make into paper. But if they kept going, it would turn all the way into sugar, and we could ferment that into alcohol. So what I'm trying to say is, if you got a paper mill in your backyard, well, sure, not a problem. You know?
Not everybody does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Doug in Sedona, Arizona, says, what about the controversy that alcohol eats aluminum parts,
such as
your fuel tank?
That was really a popular myth in New Zealand when I was there. The oil companies were really promoting that one, and they did it last year in Australia. And they did it 20 years ago here, and there are vestiges of that rumor still floating around. So basically, alcohol is compatible with all parts of your car. There's nothing in your car anymore that can be corroded or damaged by alcohol. Prior to 1983, some of the vehicle rubber parts were susceptible to swelling with alcohol and would fail. But since 1983, pretty much all that's been done away with, because at that point we started putting alcohol in the gas around the country. And since car companies never knew where their car would end up, they had to make it compatible with alcohol. So we haven't really seen any problems with corrosion or rubber failure since 1983. And in Brazil, they've been running cars that are much older than that, because people never throw anything away there. And for those of you who don't know, Brazil runs 85% of its cars on alcohol and imports, count them, not one barrel of oil, period, you know, because they don't need it. Their cars are running on alcohol.
Joyous Rainbow from Arizona, I love that name, wants to know about the use of hemp.
Well, hemp would be a cellulose product mostly. In other words, you'd be converting that plant fiber into alcohol. And in theory, you could get about 600 or 700 gallons an acre. But again, it's not a small-scale process. The other problem, of course, is that hemp as a fabric, as a, you know, well, as a cloth, is so much more valuable than turning it into fuel. The byproduct for making cloth are the hemp herds, which is the rough cellulose left over, actually would be a good material to make alcohol from in a larger plant that could convert cellulose.
All right. Howard from Marion, Virginia. Currently, there's about, what, 5% alcohol in fuel right now. Will that ever go up at the pumps?
You know, it'll go up when we have more alcohol, because basically it's the best way to raise octane. You know, gasoline comes out of the refinery at 64 octane. Then you got to add stuff to it. So the stuff we currently add to it is benzene, toluene, and xylene. So, you know, those all sound like exotic names, but just think cancer, 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 you know, and that's what we're adding to gasoline to bring the octane up. Alcohol does that without those problems. So oil companies actually, as much as they hate using alcohol, make more money when they use alcohol to raise octane. Now, certain states, like Minnesota, are mandating 20% in the next couple of years, and other states are talking about even higher percentages. So it probably won't happen on the federal level, although if I could talk to someone in the Obama camp, we might mandate that, because there's no reason that we can't go to at least 30% nationwide. And guess what? You know, 30% is all we get from OPEC right now. 30% of our oil comes from OPEC.
That's right.
So if we only replace 30% without modifying anything on anyone's car, we could tell the OPEC countries to, like, see if they can eat their oil. You know, we don't need to buy it, you know.
Rich from Council Bluffs, Iowa. My check engine light comes on when I use ethanol. How come?
Well, that's really kind of a funny thing, because, you know, your check engine light is mostly an emissions testing light. And so what happens is your emissions drop so low that the computer says, oh, no, there must be something wrong. This car could not be running that clean. There must be a sensor out or something. And so the check engine light comes on. You can pretty much ignore that. It doesn't mean anything.
Michael from California. I own a bakery. I've got a natural gas oven that is rated at 300,000 BTUs. Is it possible to run this oven on alcohol? If so, how do you do that?
Okay, so here's how I'm going to show you why ecologists are worth the big bucks. So you've got a bakery, which means you're using yeast to make your bread rise. The yeast eats sugar in your dough, and they make alcohol and carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide is what makes the bread rise, with all the little bubbles of carbon dioxide from the yeast puff up the bread. When you cook the bread in that oven, the alcohol evaporates out of the bread and goes up the flue. In Sweden, they put chillers on the top of the flue, and they condense the alcohol out of the, you know, the flue exhaust gases, and then they use the alcohol to run their delivery trucks. So that's a long answer to say, yes, you've got a product coming out of your flue that you're making alcohol every day with your bread, and you could recover that. Now, you can run the oven on alcohol just fine. In fact, marine stoves, in other words, the stoves that you have on boats, always run on alcohol because it's the only safe fuel on a boat. So we've been using alcohol for cooking for nearly forever. And, you know, that brings up an important point, because 2.4 billion people around the world cook over wood right now, and it's the fourth leading cause of death, you know, breathing wood smoke inside these developing country homes. So So Sweden has started programs of supplying alcohol stoves in these villages, and instead of people walking 6 hours one way to get enough firewood to cook for the week, they're encouraging people in villages to grow crops like cassava, starchy root crop, they can make into alcohol, feed the byproduct to their animals, and cook over the alcohol in their houses safely so women don't have eye injuries, kids don't have lung injuries, and it just saves a country a fortune in health care costs. So here you go. Alcohol is really the healthiest fuel to be using inside.
Bob in Seattle, he lives 35 miles away from an E85 station in the Seattle area. He wants to know when some more are going to open up.
Well, you know, why don't you open one, Bob? I mean, that's what I'm doing in Santa Cruz. We have almost no stations in California. And so what we talk about doing is, in the book, is what we call community-supported energy. The idea that neighbors get together, they find some dying mall somewhere that's got a lot of asphalt that's not making money, and they put an above-ground alcohol station in a corner of the parking lot. So it's basically a tank and a pump, and you swipe your card through it and fill your car up. This doesn't cost very much. This would be like $200 or $300 per person who would sign up to have their own station, a driver-owned station. So you could start off by buying the alcohol, but then if you've got a station like that, you can put out the word that you'd like a farmer to supply that station, and you're looking to give that farmer a contract to supply the station. You'll find a farmer to take you up on that. So that whole concept of cutting out the middlemen kind of starts with you, Bob, starting an alcohol station in your church parking lot, in your mall parking lot, in the overly big yard for some business that isn't so busy anymore. In other words, there's a lot of commercial places you can set up a community alcohol station. And now you've started a revolution.
Tom from Oregon, compare the gas mileage from gasoline to ethanol.
Well, you know, it all depends. You know, if you build an engine that's supposed to really run on alcohol, and the DOE has done this. They took a Volkswagen TDI diesel engine, and they did modifications to it and ran straight alcohol in it. They got 22% better mileage than they got on diesel. And diesel already is half again better mileage than gasoline. So we can get really good mileage, and China is already building these engines for heavy trucks. They're eating our lunch again. We should be doing that here. And, you know, if I was Obama and I'm bailing out the car companies, I'd insist they make alcohol engines.
We'll be back and take phone calls next hour with David Bloom on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm with David Bloom. We're going to take your phone calls as well. David, please remind me that we want to talk about how Coast listeners can participate in this, okay?
Be happy
before
to do that.
Before we're off the air. Let's go to Ryan in Kansas City, Missouri, east of the Rockies. Get us going, Ryan.
George, gosh, love your show. Good topic and guest this evening.
Thank you.
Real quick, guys, I'm wondering what impact we'll have when we remove the starch and sugar from what we feed our livestock. How will this impact their methane gas production?
Well, that's a really good question. Part of the problem, the reason why cattle have methane gas farts, basically, is that starch and sugar are getting eaten by methane bacteria. Without that starch, in the feed, you get a lot less of it, so it reduces global warming. So, you know, we can reduce cow farts, which is reason enough to go to alcohol fuel.
Okay, good. Let's go to Leota, west of the Rockies. Hey there.
Hi. Hi, David. We have a mutual friend with Gayla.
Yes.
My question is, I had read that 1,200 families every day are becoming homeless. And winter's coming on, and I'm just really concerned with them staying warm. And I had heard, I want to run this past you, that you can take alcohol and cotton swabs and put it on the top of the alcohol and burn it to stay warm. And I also had discovered in a little studio place that I had, I took cinder blocks, like the foundation blocks, and turned them vertical where the two holes are and put candles in there, and it radiated the heat. It retained and radiated the heat. What would be a good idea for these people to stay warm?
Well, you know, the best thing that would help them stay warm is having a job and have an income. You know, I mean, that's why they're becoming homeless. And, you know, I know it's not a direct answer to your question, but if we were producing alcohol in this country, we would not have unemployment anymore. Now, in terms of direct use of alcohol for heat, there's little alcohol heaters that you can put alcohol in, and they, you know, are safe to use inside a car or inside a closed space because they don't put out any carbon monoxide. And you can also make alcohol stoves for cooking out of nothing more than 3 soda cans and some high-temperature epoxy, which we, usually have a link to whatever the best design is on the book because, you know, around the world, that would replace a lot of wood fires and can be used for heating as well as for cooking and literally cost you $5 to make. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to go about doing that. But, you know, I think we got to solve the problems of this country at the root, which is stop using oil and start making our own energy and food. And I think all of us will be better off.
How did you get interested in this, David?
Oh, gosh. Well, I had this wild teacher in college. He was in his last year. He was about to retire, so nobody could touch him, you know. So he would just lie to us with a straight face, totally deadpan, to see if we'd catch him, you know, and he had a standard bet. If you caught him in a lie, he'd take you out to lunch and buy you a burrito. So one day there was this big, you know, 5-gallon bottle of fermenting beer on the counter because we were studying yeast, and he said, that stuff would run your car. And I looked at him, and I figured I had my burrito. I said, you're a liar. This guy actually had a method to his madness because being that he was a good teacher, he turned to me and said, prove it, in front of the whole class, right? So, like, well, what was I going to do, you know? So I went off to the library figuring this will be a piece of cake. There's never been anything other than gasoline. And I came back with this enormous stack of books about the history of alcohol. And I was floored that this secret history existed, and no one I knew even had heard about it. We've actually arranged to have some of these old books on alcohol that have been off of copyright reprinted. You know, a friend of ours is doing that, and we now have them on our site as well, which I haven't said for a long time, so that's that alcohol can be a gas. And we also got an email that your assistant sent me a few minutes ago. Gwyneth had written and said, is there another way to get to us other than the website? And you can call us. We actually are real people. We have a phone number. So you can get us at 888-PERMACULTURE, which is 737-6228, if you want to get a hold of any of this information. So, you know, the thing that hooked me was the secret history. And, you know, basically the oil companies have been manipulating what we know about alcohol forever. We talked a lot in the past, George, about prohibition actually mm-hmm. being totally paid for by Rockefeller to get alcohol off the market as a fuel, and it had nothing to do with drinking. There's, you know, incident after incident in history of this going on.
Next up, let's go to Wildcard Line in Richmond, Virginia. Josie. Hi, Josie.
Hi, y'all. I just am wondering how your program, David, compares with Dr. Robert Zubrin, who talked about sugar from sugarcane being mm-hmm. the best biomass fuel to use and how it could help the third world and also cut down terrorism because people in certain third world areas would have then jobs growing sugarcane, which we all can use, whether it be in the West or here. And he talked about mandating the cars so that they would have the fuel flex capability, which they already know how to do. So they're not asking them to retool a whole bunch of manufacturing in their shops. And then these cars would be going to China and India, which all wants those kinds of cars. What do you think of that as a method? Because so many of us do not know how to make. We don't have the technology to make all of this, or don't have big backyards or what have you. And I wondered if that was as good or better than making our own little stills.
Well, there's a couple of things in your question. And what I would say is Zubrin's book is an excellent book. And it talks more about why we should go to alcohol. And it's a good complement to my book, which tells you how to go there, you know, how to get it done. And Zubrin makes several good points, which is one of the main ones is that our oil system is extremely vulnerable. I have a photo in my book of the Alaska pipeline where a drunken hunter went out one day with his rifle and put a hole in the pipeline and shut it down for 2 weeks. There's 100,000 miles of pipeline exposed around the world. So, you know, all it takes is a little bit of dynamite, and, you know, you've crippled the Western world for a couple of weeks.
Well, that's true with regular oil. But what about with importing sugar and having little biomass factories in local communities all over the country?
Well, we don't need to import sugar to do that. It's more efficient, actually, to make alcohol wherever that country is and just ship the alcohol instead of all the sugar. But we don't need a sugar cane to do this with. And, you know, this is where my book goes a little farther out than Zubrin, which is that there's a many crops we can use in this country that are very practical for alcohol fuel. I mean, we've got Jerusalem artichokes. We've got sweet sorghum. We've got fodder beets we can use. We can even go into the deserts and use mesquite pods from naturally growing mesquite trees or prickly pear cactus. In other words, I cover all this in the book. So what I'm saying is that, you know, rather than using energy to move sugar around from one place to the next, we grow it here with our own sunlight, and that makes us even more secure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next up, let's move it on to our next wild card line, Daryl. Driving around in Indiana. Go ahead, Daryl.
Hey, George, thank you for taking my call. And, David, I have a question for you. I was looking through my wife's minivan, the Chrysler minivan, and it said in the owner's manual that it can be changed over to be an E85 vehicle, but you have to change the oil in the vehicle in order for it to be an E85 vehicle. Is there any truth to that, or is that just Chrysler trying to yank your chain on to get you to buy something you don't really need?
Well, not exactly. You know, remember we talked a little earlier about how clean alcohol is. Well, it will also clean all the carbon out of your engine. So when you switch over to E85, it's going to clean the whole inside of your engine, and all that carbon is going to end up in the oil. So then you have to go ahead and change the oil because you've really made it dirty because you've cleaned out all this accumulated crud. So it's just good maintenance, you know, to not run too long with all that carbon in your oil.
All right.
But once it's cleaned out, you're done. You know, your oil changes can actually be less frequent, you know, especially if you use synthetic oil. You can go 25,000, 30,000 miles between oil changes.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Okay, my next question is, I myself have a 1996 Subaru Impreza. How hard would it be to get a kit to make the conversion so I can run that on alcohol?
Oh, yeah, our kits work on Subarus just fine. You know, there's very few cars that can't be, using a kit to run. But you can also use techniques from the book to be able to convert even without the kit. So either which way, you can do it. But how many cylinders do you have in that?
It's a basic four cylinder. It's a 2.2 liter.
Yeah, so that's about $360 for a kit that takes care of that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's move on to another caller, John in Beaumont, Texas, first-time caller. Hey, John, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, George?
Good.
And, David, it's an honor to talk to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks.
I had a question, actually two questions. First off, David, I need to know, I have an old 74 Chrysler Newport, and it's got a 400 V8 under the hood, old Chrysler motor. I need to know if I convert that to alcohol, will I need to change any of the seals in it?
No, there's never been an issue with alcohol and seals. And odds are, a long time ago, you know, you've changed the fuel pump because, you know, 1974, the original one's probably not it anymore, and you've changed it once or twice. And, you know, as long as you change it after 1983, it's going to be alcohol compatible. And that car is carbureted unless you've gone ahead and, you know, put a throttle body fuel injection on it. So carburation is actually, about $50 in parts, and you just do the conversion yourself. There's no kit for that. And we have all the instructions even for carbureted cars in the book.
Yeah, actually, you're right. The engine was rebuilt back in 2006. It was a car I drove in high school, and yeah, you're right. I know how to do all the carburation work on it and stuff like that. I just need to know about the seals. But also, I was talking to an old roommate of mine, and he's an engineer major, and we were talking one night, and I told him about you, and we got to talking over a couple of beers, and all of a sudden we come up with this idea about starting, you know, a couple of ethanol stations down here in Beaumont where, you know, most of the gasoline from the nation comes. And we just wanted to know how we would get started by that, starting a couple of ethanol stations trying to get that in.
Well, I'd see you really like to live dangerously in oil country making an alcohol station.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. You know, the basic idea, I think, is to get people interested so that you have a core group of people that want to work with you, because you may need some muscle when it comes to permits and city hall, and it's good if you've already organized a bunch of people who want a station like that. So several people have taken my DVD and shown it locally, you know, so people can see the whole story about alcohol and why they ought to do it. And then you organize a group around that, and now you go ahead and you can kind of divide up the task. You know, somebody can work with looking for sites. So once you find a site, then two or three people can work on, you know, going through the permit process with the city to put your, you know, put your station in. And, you know, in other words, it's a lot easier if you're working with some other people to make this happen. And when you need to exercise a little muscle, it's good to show up at a planning commission or a city council meeting with, you know, 30 people. It's like, oh, let's see, 30 people showed up. That's like 3,000 votes. We better pay attention to these guys, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's always good to go in there organized with a group when you're starting off something like this. And as we pointed out, if you're doing this as a driver-owned co-op, you know, and you guys are managing it, you know, it can be a nice middle-class living for you, and you're helping everybody get their fuel. As the earlier caller said, you know, maybe they can't make fuel, but you go ahead and supply it for them, and you contract with farmers to supply you with the alcohol, you're all set.
Yeah, and we've got a lot of rice farmers down here that would just love to do that, love to get the little extra income in.
Well, rice, you know, when they mill the rice, there's dust left over, which is pure starch, and they don't know what to do with that stuff usually because it's too fine to use for animal feed, and they pay you to haul that away, and you can get about 100 gallons per ton of rice dust.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, that white rice, it's pretty much pure starch and no food, so, you know.
Any problems with deforestation at all, trying to get this alcohol?
Oh, I think the world's got a big problem with deforestation, you know. And, you know, George, we already actually hit on the solution about this. Alcohol reverses that, because the biggest engine of deforestation isn't timber cutting. It's basically cooking. In other words, people needing to cut wood to cook does more deforestation than anything else. So by shifting people over to cooking with alcohol, you actually, you know, stop the deforestation that happens for cooking fuel. It's one of those counterintuitive things. There is so much land that is not in forest that we can use for growing crops for fuel. There's never a reason to cut down trees to set up farmland for fuel farming. We just don't need to do it. We have so much land that we can use. Brazil alone, I mean, Brazil has 400 million extra acres of basically grassland that is degraded pasture that can be used for producing alcohol. You don't need to go near any forest to go ahead and do this. And why would you go through the expense of clearing a forest when you've already got grasslands or like in the Southwest near desert? I mean, you can use land that isn't good for anything else and now produce, you know, profit and alcohol.
Let's go west of the Rockies, Lance, in Alaska. Hey, Lance.
Oh, what an honor, George and David.
Thank you.
Well, I know the benefits of alcohol. I won 5 different state championships over the years, mud racing an old alcohol truck and everything. And my question is for you up here in Alaska, what kind of crop would you recommend for me to do this? Because, you know, I weld and fabricate and mechanic and all that, so I plan on building my own plant, excuse me. So
let me knock your socks off. If you're anywhere near the coast, the crop that I would use is kelp, because whenever there's a wind come up and there's a little bit of a storm, that stuff piles up on the beach 10 feet high, right?
Oh, man, yeah.
Right. Well, kelp is corn sugar made into big chains. So kelp, you know, is free for the taking off the beach, and it's pretty simple to make into alcohol. There's a few tricks to it, but basically kelp is, you know, like your free for the taking source. Now, here's the deal about kelp, which is like so amazing. If we went ahead and grew kelp, in places that are polluted, like, you know, the dead zone at the mouth of the Mississippi, or, you know, that really cesspool of Washington, D.C., you know.
Sure.
All, you know, the Chesapeake Bay dumps out into the, you know, the ocean, et cetera. All that extra surplus nutrients, if you grew kelp there, you could actually supply the whole country on just the alcohol from the kelp and never plant a single seed in the ground. You know, we could actually provide all that. And the kelp solution left over after you make the alcohol, you could pipeline that to the Midwest and get rid of all chemical fertilizer that you need.
There's so many benefits to alcohol. I can't believe, you know, I know there's some other things that you have that you're probably not mentioning. I have your book here, too, by the way. So,
oh, good.
Really appreciate it. It'd be nice to get this country, you know, out of the clutches of the oil companies.
Well, I don't think we have a choice. We have to. You know, we have to get out of the clutches of the oil companies because basically these guys are parasites draining the capital out of our communities. And if we don't, you know, start taking care of this ourselves, we're eventually going to end up being slaves to these guys. I mean, just think about the oil companies buying your farmland and what that means. You know, and no one is going to help us do this. The government's not going to help us do it. I mean, they'd like to, you know, the current government, but, you know, they've got a lot of priorities in satisfying the people that, you know, fund their campaigns, and a lot of those are corporations. Corporations aren't going to help us. It's really up to us to do it ourselves. And, you know, we can do this. You know, making alcohol on the small scale is profitable. It's a good small business. It keeps money in the community. And we don't need any help to do it. It's affordable. We can afford to do this. So, you know, it's just basically time for us to start this revolution.
We'll be back with final phone calls with David Bloom in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David, before we go to final calls, why don't you take a few moments to tell us about how people can participate in this revolution?
Well, there's a lot of ways. And, you know, the first way that anyone, you know, can directly get involved is take the first step. Find a station in your area. That's easily done by checking it out on our website. We have a map to all of them. And start using alcohol. Stop giving the oil companies your money. You know, so without modifying anything, put a gallon in with this tank, put 2 gallons in with the next tank, and keep going up until, you know, you get up to around 50% or so. You might go farther, and you'll know if you've gone too far when your car has less power. You know, and so then you know, okay, I can only go to 55% or whatever. But, you know, it's safe to go up to 50% for every car. So that's the first thing you need to do is stop giving the oil companies your money. Now, we need a lot of help in terms of pushing things forward. And we'd really invite you to join our mailing list so that we can let you know when the oil companies are pushing some sort of attack like they tried last year with removing the alcohol fuel mandate. Oil Patch Perry, the governor of Texas, tried to do that. And, you know, basically our mailing list, which we call Alcoholics Unanimous, sent thousands and thousands of letters to the EPA, and they didn't let the waiver happen. So we were really effective, and we need to be more effective. So we've got a lot of giveaways we're putting on the website right now for anyone who signs up on the mailing list, anything from your own private home fueling station, which is really a 55-gallon drum of alcohol and a pump. But also conversion kits we're giving away. We're giving seats to our workshops away. Anything to get you guys to sign up so that we can draw on you from time to time when we need to defend the alcohol industry against big oil. We don't ever give out the mailing list to anyone, and we don't sell it to anyone, and we don't send you a lot of emails. But when we do send it to you, we really appreciate the help in pushing this forward.
Okay, back to the phones now. Riverside, California, we go. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Oh, what a phenomenal show tonight.
Thank you.
Absolutely an honor talking to you. This has just got me brainstorming. Looking at the financial crisis that's going on right now, there are so many folks like myself that have just pulled out of all the financials and all the oil stocks and things like that, and we're looking for things like this. And one thing I thought of was a whole complete new service industry. Whereas not only do we start using alcohol, but we get people completely off the grid by supplying them with whatever kits or things are necessary to their home and just have the alcohol truck come by and drop it off.
Well, so you're right on to it. So you could start a business by spending $6,000, $7,000 and buying a fuel truck. deliver alcohol to tanks just like people's fuel oil tanks. The alcohol can run their fuel oil burner with $20 worth of modification, and you can run a generator with the alcohol, which provides not only the electricity for the house, but you throw the radiator away from the generator, and now you use the engine to heat the water for the house.
Well, there you go. Also, it would be nice to see some sort of a model for, like, people who want to build a home or have a given amount of land and have their soil tested and say it's best for corn or it's best for sorghum or it's best for cattails, and a whole model, not only using that, but to integrate it into a greenhouse and supply the home, as well as the first idea with taking them off the grid. Models like that, I've just been brainstorming the last hour.
Well, you're right on to what we need to do, and we're out there right now hoping to raise money to build the integrated alcohol farm teaching center so people can come out, learn how to do this, and then take it back to where they live. And, you know, it's kind of a struggle getting the money for this, but we're looking for it.
Well, great. Well, I plan on keep on touch. Can you give me your website address?
Sure. You can get a hold of us at alcoholcanbeagas.com, and you can also call us on the phone at 888-PERMACULTURE, which is 737-6228.
Phenomenal call. Phenomenal program, I mean. I've just enjoyed it thoroughly. Thank you so much for being on the planet.
Thanks.
They love this, David, don't they?
Well, you do good work, George. I mean, that's the whole point of having people like me and Zubrin and Matt Stein and all the great people you have on. It's like, you know, enough of us get out there and the Coast listeners go start doing this stuff. We're going to change things.
The Pair of Wisconsin. Keith, it's your turn. Go ahead, Keith.
Hey, thank George. You. George, we the creatures of the night salute you.
Well, I salute you back.
I've got some issues with this. Because
all right, go ahead.
Okay, like that guy calling from Riverside, California. What are they going to do when their air is so polluted with formaldehyde that they notice an increase in bronchitis and other lung ailments, first of all? Second of all, I've never noticed any increase in fuel economy either in my 99 Dakota or in my motorcycle whenever I've used alcohol fuels. I can see a drop in my fuel economy when I use just 10% ethanol. So why would I want to go and use something that's going to have me spending more time at the pump?
Well, you know, it depends. There's a wide variation in the response of an engine to alcohol depending on how the software is designed and how the engine is designed. So the DOE did a recent study on a wide variety of vehicles and found the majority of them gained mileage, not much, just a little, 1%, in one case 15%, but most of them were 1%, 2%, 3%, up to 40% alcohol. Now, some vehicles lost mileage, some gained, but the average was basically no change, you know, pretty much the same. But it is true, when you get into high levels of alcohol, that you probably lose 10 or 12% miles per gallon. But again, if you're making it for a dollar a gallon, you're taking home 61 cents a gallon tax credit, you know, it's okay to lose 10% miles per gallon.
Indeed. What about the formaldehyde? What's that?
Oh, well, now that study was done by what we in California call the Global Warming is Good for You grant. It's the $100 million that Exxon gave to Stanford. So the guy went ahead and did a study that said if you converted all of the cars in L.A. to alcohol, well, the alcohol leaking out through the walls of the flexible hoses in your engine compartment would get into the air, and that would cause some changes in air chemistry that would create formaldehyde and ozone, and that might cause 200 people more a year to die in L.A. Well, being from San Francisco, we thought that was a good start, but, you know, actually, the study was not only flawed and inconclusive, but it ignored the fact that 14,000 people a year die in L.A. from lung-related disease from gasoline. So, you know, even if the study was true, the net effect of the alcohol would be to actually save a lot of people's lives. But, you know, you cherry-pick the data, you can, you know, make it say whatever you want.
Next up, let's go to Frank in Columbia, South Carolina, east of the Rockies. Hey, Frank.
Hey, George, pleasure to speak with you, buddy. I've logged a lot of miles with you in Art, especially since Art's early days of Coast to Coast.
Well, thanks for the ride.
And my question for Dave is, and I'll answer real quick and get out of the way, but as far as the diesel big trucks, how hard would it be to convert one of these over to straight alcohol? And I think you've already pretty much answered my mileage question on it, but how hard would that be? And would I be able to get that information from your website? And I'll take my answer off there.
Well, I don't think we don't have the detailed information on the website for converting diesels to alcohol, but we do have six ways of doing it in the book. There are different ways of converting diesels depending on what kind of diesel it is. In other words, if it's a tractor, well, it doesn't accelerate or decelerate a lot, or neither does a generator. So those conversions are simpler than some of the ones that might be, say, for your over-the-road truck. But Archer Daniels Midland, which has the biggest trucking fleet in the United States, well, that's probably second after Walmart now, but they did a very big study where they basically ran on straight alcohol, and I'll tell you what they did was they put in full-time glow plugs. Now, glow plugs are usually what you use to start a diesel engine on a cold morning.
Well, that's right.
But because alcohol has a low cetane rating, it tends not to explode early enough in the cycle, and by having the hot spot of the glow plug in there, it goes off at exactly the right time just fine. So they were able to run on basically straight alcohol on their over-the-road trucks, and they did probably close to 1 million miles in testing and found it worked just fine. That was back in the 80s. And there's other techniques we show in the book, like mixing biodiesel with alcohol, and you can use that without modification. And some crazy farmers in South Dakota, Ori Swayze and company, figured that out, and there's been a lot of testing on it. Works really well. So, yes, there's no reason why we can't run our diesels on alcohol just like we do our gasoline engines.
Let's go to Alaska, Pat, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, hi. Hi. I'd like to know if it makes sense to use alcohol to as the fuel to operate your still.
Well, you know, I get asked that a lot. And, you know, you could say energy is energy, and so whatever has it, you can use it for whatever purpose. But different forms of energy are more valuable for different purposes than other things. So you're up in Alaska where you've got a surplus of trees. Now, you can't run your car on wood very easily. So, I mean, it is possible to run your car on smoke, and it's a long story. They did it in Germany at the end of the war, yada, yada. But, you know, it's a lot easier to use wood for heat and use alcohol for more valuable uses, like running your car or running a generator, which might be hard to do with wood. So it's like, you know, you might pick the form of energy most appropriate to the use. And wood is, you know, perfectly renewable. It's, you know, a biomass fuel made from sunlight just like alcohol. And so, you know, if it was me in Alaska, I'd probably use wood to run my still and save my alcohol to run my car.
Well, what kind of ratio would it be? I mean, would it be like a perpetual motion that you can't have? Or
no, it's not perpetual motion because the input of energy is solar energy. So, you know, the plants take in solar energy, you ferment them, you make them into alcohol, and then you use some energy to distill the alcohol out of the mash. But the input of energy really came from the sun. So you can get out of, in other words, if you were to do it all with alcohol, you would use 1 gallon of alcohol to distill 6 gallons of alcohol. That's about how much energy you would need to separate the alcohol from the mash.
Okay, well, that's kind of just what I was wondering. I mean, as far as, you know, if you get more out than what you're putting in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not an issue. Even big plants do that now. I wrote in my book that basically alcohol plants in the U.S. would start to go the way of Brazil, where they start to use renewables to run the plant. And the very first U.S. plant about a month ago switched over from using natural gas to using corn cobs as its boiler fuel, you know, the center of the, you know, ear of corn. And they're getting 6 units out for every unit in.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Nancy in Sheboygan Falls, Wisconsin, east of the Rockies. Nancy, you're on with David Bloom.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for the great show. I just wanted to mention that there were some guys around in Wisconsin here, two guys. They took the leftover grease from fryers from restaurants, and they made their own fuel. And it was all okay until the government found out about it, and then they were shut down because the IRS said that they owed all kinds of taxes, thousands of dollars worth of taxes that they owed. And I can't figure that out. As long as they weren't selling it to anybody else, why should they have been able to do that?
Well, here's the deal. So what they were making was biodiesel, which is vegetable oil converted into diesel fuel. Now, what they were doing is getting it from restaurants or whatever, but, you know, it wasn't like that stuff was going to waste. There was somebody already picking up that oil. And, you know, quite typically that's Darling International, which is a mafia-owned company, and, you know, they don't like losing their contracts. So they go to the restaurant owner one day and say, well, where's the oil? And they go, this kid down the street's picking it up. I don't need you guys to pick it up anymore. So the guy from the grease company says, wow, that sounds like a good idea. Maybe I'd like to buy some of that fuel from him. Can you give me the kid's name? So they get the name, and then they call up the road tax people, because you're supposed to pay tax if you use the roads when you buy fuel. And they also go after them, usually for transporting the grease, which is regulated as hazardous waste. So it's funny. The vegetable oil comes into the restaurant. It's food. When it leaves, it's hazardous waste.
Well, won't they do that to us then if we do our own then? And one more question about the alcohol. Pure alcohol is really dangerous because you can't see it when it burns. You know, like if like the race car drivers, you never know when they have an accident, whether there's a flame or not.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. You'll see that at races where there's a wreck, and you'll see this guy waving his arms and flapping all over the place, and you can't really see the flame out in the sunlight. And that's because alcohol burns so clean. There's no color to it. It's a light blue color, and in bright light, you can't see it. But when we use it as fuel, we add 2% gasoline to it because we're forced to. But it does have a safety aspect to it. In other words, the government says you got to make the alcohol undrinkable. So
okay, so if we make our own, are they going to tax us and shut us down? Like, you know, are we going to have to owe taxes to somebody?
Well, now, you know, if you're going to be a good citizen and you're going to use the roads, you ought to pay your road taxes. And so, you know, that's something that you're technically supposed to do, even if you make your own fuel. Now, that being said, if you make alcohol and you use the alcohol in your generator, well, you don't pay road tax on that. And if you use it in your fuel oil burner, you don't pay road tax on that. And if you use it for cooking, you don't pay road tax for that. Or if you use it on a piece of equipment that's on your property that doesn't go on the road. So it's really up to you to keep very good records about how you use your alcohol. And it's amazing how much your generator uses.
Okay, this Darling company, by the way, is a publicly held company, David. I don't know how it got its start, though.
Yes, well, it's got an interesting history nowadays.
Time for one or two more. Springfield, Ohio. Brian, go ahead. Brian?
Yes, I'm right here. I put my phone on mute, sorry.
Okay, that's
I am a technician, and I work in the field a lot. What my question is I've seen problems with gaskets going bad with people that would transfer their start going, like, from gasoline to the alcohol. My question is how much of a mixture should they go slightly by, like a gallon of alcohol to 10 gallons of gas, or how should they go about that?
Well, how old are these vehicles you're talking about?
Go ahead. We only got about 40 seconds left, David. So give us a general answer.
Yeah, basically, gaskets nowadays since 1983 are all alcohol proof. And prior to that, they may not be. And so if it's an old vehicle, you know, that gasket was about to go anyway. But alcohol helped it along.
Get the websites out again, David.
AlcoholCanBeAGas.com. And the phone number is 888-737-6228.
When do you see this nation making a huge push this way?
You know, this new administration, you know, has some real promise. Obama has a 100% voting record on alcohol fuel, so he understands the importance of it, and he's actually co-authored legislation which failed in the past to actually convert this nation over to alcohol in short order, you know, and enforcing flexible fuel vehicles and providing incentives for alcohol fuel plants. So there's hope that he'll be able to push that through now that he's in a position to do it.
Thanks, David. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom, Dan Heiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.